Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 1:21 p.m. It's Monday, March 27, 2017. Before we begin, I would like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kyle Schramm from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Kopp, Representative Eastman, Representative Reinbold, Representative Ledoux, Representative Christ Tompkins, my Vice Chair Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have full attendance, and we have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 123, Disclosure of Health Care Costs, which is sponsored by Representative Sponholz. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. And while it had originally been my intent to move this bill today as a result of conversations between Representative Christ Tompkins, who may be offering an amendment, and as well as the bill sponsor, my expectation is we will hear this today and then hear it one more time on Wednesday when we will hear the potential amendment and then move the bill. On Friday, Representative Sponholz presented the bill and we heard public testimony. Representative Sponholz is with us again, and I'll invite her up to give us a brief recap of the bill and answer any further questions. Please come to the table and identify yourself for the record.
Hi, I am Representative Sponholz from District 16 in East Anchorage. House Bill 123, an act relating to disclosure of healthcare services and price information, is about price transparency, bringing back into the healthcare marketplace an element of the free market, which does not exist right now, unfortunately, for healthcare consumers. We don't know at the point of purchase of services, or even most of the time in preparation for looking for healthcare, what things cost, unless we call and ask for special quotes and rates. And I'd like to, through this bill, introduce a more price competition, the conversation about price competition, as well as comparing prices into healthcare consumerism. Would you like me to go through sort of the bill's components in any way, or okay?
No, I don't think so. I do know there was a document. I'm not sure this came from your office or whether that came from Representative Christ Tompkins, but the 50 top mm-hmm. CPT codes from hospital number one, is that from your office?
We both asked for it.
So if you want to tell us a little bit about what this is and what you its significance
pass it,
is.
Pass it up. I don't have it with me.
It's passed up.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I don't have it with me. Can I have it? Oh, sorry. So what this is was at the request of, thank you, we requested through ASHNA, through Becky Holtberg, a list of the top 50 most frequently offered services or provided services by one of the member organizations. The member organization's name is not listed here. This is not exactly the way they would be listed the way the bill requires them. We actually ask for services listed by CPT code, which is the designation is appropriate in the third column here, with a description that's written in plain language so that a non-medical professional can understand it, along with the undiscounted price. So what we're looking at here is a very different sort of list. It is the CPT code description, which is for billing purposes, along with the CPT code number and the number of times this service was offered at this particular hospital throughout the 2016 year. So you can see that the vast majority of services that were offered in this particular hospital were either labs of some kind or emergency department treatments.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So I see it says, like, charge CPT code.
Right.
And does that count how many times people have had the procedure?
The CPT code is just really the number that is used for medical billing purposes. Over to the right, the 2016 count is the number of times that service was provided within that facility.
Okay, thank you.
So I just do want to clarify that this is a listing, you know, this is a description of CPT codes as the medical billing people see them, not as we have, we've asked for them to be provided in the bill, which is a little bit different. The other thing that's important to note is in our bill, we distinguish between individual providers of healthcare and facilities. So a hospital clearly would fall into the facility category and would offer a lot more, offers a lot more services because of the volume and the scope of their services. So we've asked for 50, their top 50 services. But in the case of an individual practitioner, which would be, you know, your family doctor, they would list the top 25 most frequently offered services. And their services would change, would vary differently depending on individual practitioner. An OBGYN is going to have very different services than a pediatrician, for example.
All right. Any other questions right now for the bill sponsor? I do want to note for the record that Jill Lewis, Deputy Director of the Division of Public Health, and Heidi Langdorfer, Chief of the Health Analytics and Vital Records, are also available for questions if there are any questions from the committee. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hi, Representative Donalds. Thank you so much for coming to my office, or me coming to your office, and talking about this bill. I really appreciated it. When we were in the office together, we had discussed the facilities, like the some of the public health in hospital. Sure. And I'm trying to figure out if that has been fixed in the bill. You said you didn't. My recollection is you didn't have a problem with them posting there, and I think it's been fixed, but I'm not sure.
On page 2 of the bill, between lines 26 and 29, section D under Article 4, a healthcare provider or healthcare facility may include a statement with a list published under C of this section explaining that the undiscounted price may be higher or lower than the amount the individual pays for the healthcare services described in this list. And essentially what this means is we're allowing for a disclaimer to be included on the price list. And that disclaimer, we're not prescribing or prescribing what that disclaimer should say specifically. So in the case of a community health center, this was brought to our attention by Alaska Primary Care Association. They have a sliding fee schedule, and so they want to make sure that potential healthcare consumers are not scared off by the undiscounted price that's being listed, and they want to make sure that it's right up there in front that that they have a sliding fee schedule, and so the actual price that a consumer would pay will be much different. And so, you know, they'd asked for that particular disclaimer, and we think that it fits in with private practitioners' needs as well to also indicate that they're a preferred provider or are, you know, covered under various health insurance plans. So,
follow-up, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you very much. So I think addressing that's important, but then they're also having, like, the Veterans Administration having Indian Health Service publishing their top 25 or top 50 expenses.
Sure.
My recollection was you didn't have an issue, and I would love that. If everyone else is going to be required to do it, I think it's only fair for the government facilities to be exposing that as well.
So what you're referencing, I'm sorry, I misunderstood what you were asking about. We discussed many things when we met.
Yes,
Representative Reinbold, is under page 3, healthcare facility line, starting in line 6, healthcare facility for the purposes of this requirement does not include the Pioneers Home, the Veterans Affone, Veterans Home, a tribal facility, a nursing facility licensed by the department to offer long-term care, and so on. So there's a few exclusions to this that were made because the way that healthcare is consumed in those services is very different. It was also brought to our attention that there could be a separation of powers issue, and that actually we don't have the authority to mandate that federally funded facilities list. We're not under the authority to mandate a lot of things that federally funded facilities do or don't do, and so that was one of the reasons that was listed in there.
Follow-up, Representative.
Okay, it's something that I think if we're going to require the private sector to do it, I'm absolutely passionate about. I thought this was going to possibly be fixed. So this is something I definitely want to address, and I'll be happy to meet with you in regards to this. But I believe that if the private sector needs to do this, I think it's only fair for the public sector to do it, especially if it's the government that's requiring it. I also got a couple emails about antitrust, or this might be in conflict with federal or antitrust laws. I'm not sure if you or your staff have been involved in that, but if you could speak to that, you know, if you've You're both shaking your heads. Well,
to clarify, I'm not sure if there's any specific antitrust statutes that are related to this. There is a domain issue, and I may not be using the correct language, but that state governments cannot tell the federal government what to do. And so my understanding was that there was that we are not we're not legally able to require, say, the Veterans Administration to list their prices. And so if the committee wanted to discuss and consider, you know, an amendment that would change the body of this bill, perhaps we should bring, you know, legal in to consult on that particular element. I did not consult with legal on that particular limitation. I was advised by professionals in the field that it was not advisable.
So, Representative Reinbold, just a couple, in terms of if you want to offer an amendment to this bill, it'll be due by 5 o'clock tomorrow. But I have not analyzed it in detail, but I would say with little question that the federal supremacy, it's not a separation of powers, but federal supremacy pretty much means none of the 50 states have the authority to order the federal government to do anything, and this would be no exception. And I know that may not be the way you'd like the world to work in connection with the state-federal relationship, but I frankly don't think there's any basis for us to require federal agencies to disclose that information, much as I would like to know the information, too, but I don't think we as a legislature can order it. But you're welcome to look into it.
Absolutely. I definitely plan on looking into it, because I think, especially if any state dollars are going into any of these facilities, I think it's only prudent for us to be wise. And my understanding is a lot of Medicaid patients do go to state funding does go to some of these facilities. So I think it's only prudent. Plus, I think it's a complete double standard to ask the private sector to do something. So big bad government's asking the private sector, private, this is private, yet they are not willing to follow the same standard. I find that completely outlandish. So I'm absolutely very, very interested in ensuring that the public sector, at least at minimum, is at the same standard that we are.
Representative Reinbold, there are facilities which are receiving public money which will be required to do this, so that there's not actually a clear, bright line between those as it relates to public funding versus not public funding. For example, the community health centers that I was describing earlier, which will be listing their prices, do receive a substantial amount of funding through Medicaid billing.
Okay. And then
follow-up question, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So does this conflict any federal laws at all that you are aware of at this time? So, a couple doctors sent me laws, and I don't have them right in front of me right now, but I didn't know if you guys had done research on whether this conflicts with federal law.
Not to my knowledge, beyond the constitutional limitations that we discussed earlier, Representative Reinbold.
Okay. I'll follow up on that later.
Representative Ledoux.
So suppose I'm insured, but just because I'm insured doesn't mean that I don't care about what it costs. And so I go to a doctor, and he's got his rack rates all up there. Is it, and then I, you know, check with another doctor, and he's got lower rack rates. Is it conceivable, because of the type of insurance that I'm carrying and the relationship between my physician and the insurance company, that the doctor with the higher rack rate is actually charging my insurance company a lower fee than the doctor with the lower rack rate?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it is possible that could be happening if the doctor in question with a higher rack rate was a preferred provider with your insurance provider and the doctor with a lower rack rate was not. If they were both preferred providers, they would likely be getting paid at the same rate. However, there will be some patients who will pay the full freight or will pay a higher percentage of that full freight, full rack rate that we were describing earlier. And so, you know, I would posit that that putting the full undiscounted price still has merit. It is the basis for which all prices are derived.
follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
But the, I mean, my question's kind of going back to the person with the insurance, and why would they care who has the higher rack rate? So if both of them are preferred providers, one could have a rack rate of $200 and one could have a rack rate of $100, and both of them are going to end up with $50 from the insurance company. Is that correct, or 50, or whatever the deal is?
In theory, it's possible. Yeah, I mean, and what you're identifying is really one of the big challenges that we have in the healthcare marketplace, and that is that there is it is very difficult to find out, you know, exactly what you're going to be paying. I don't claim that this bill solves that problem. What this bill does is get is help consumers understand that that some healthcare is expensive, some healthcare is less expensive. It gets more information out to the consumer, which is the point of it. It's also designed to stimulate a conversation between individual healthcare consumers and the billing department and their doctor. It's important that we understand how healthcare is consumed. In follow-up to an earlier discussion that we had on the hearing on Friday, we, received a letter, and I hope that you got it as well, from Jeff Ranf, who is the co-chair of the legislative community for the Committee of the Alaska Association of Healthcare Underwriters, who reminded us that while, it's not always clear to individuals that somebody is paying full freight, even if they aren't paying full freight, the fact is that our healthcare costs are dramatically increasing because we have a disconnect between the end user of healthcare services and those that are charging for it. And this bill is one tiny step forward in an overall, a long-term marathon is the analogy I used last Friday, that I'd say this is the first mile of a marathon in trying to reduce healthcare costs. This is one small piece of even, a strategy of the 5K, I guess, to use your analogy from Friday, to advance that. So there's many other things that need to be done, and there's other different forms of legislation and proposals that have been put out there. This one is a very simple to implement, a simple to understand strategy that will help inform the conversation and the dialogue about what healthcare costs.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I love running, so this is a race I can't wait to be a part of. Actually, my comment is a little bit latent, but I might as well add to the chorus, more directed to Representative Reinbold, to particularly, I guess, encourage legal diligence if we go down in that direction. I appreciate the place we're trying to get, but also sort of cognizant of legal realities, whether they're desirable or undesirable. But that's my only comment, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Yeah, go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, question just to take a step back, maybe a step or two. I wanted to get a better understanding of how it is that we get here to where this problem and as large a problem as it is. I think we can all see that there's definitely problems here. How do we get here, particularly with healthcare? Why do we have such lack of transparency? And certainly, when I go to hire a lawyer, I probably can get access to an hourly charge. I may not know exactly how long, a particular case is going to take, but I have, some ways of understanding what that cost is going to be. When I go to the hardware store, I've got a more simpler price. Why is it that healthcare seems to be going down such a very different road? Do we get to the point where we're trying to pass a bill like this to fix it?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's a big question. But I would posit that we actually started the journey into opacity in healthcare pricing when we introduced healthcare insurance. And the original, the first provider of health care insurance was what is now Premier Blue Cross. It was a group of doctors that came together to try to put together a funding structure that made it more affordable for regular working people to get health care and to afford their services. And I think, you know, that's a laudable goal. It was essentially financing for health care, right? You know that when you get health care, it's sometimes expensive. It's easier to, you know, spread out your payments over a longer period of time than it is to pay it all at once. And that was the beginning of, I think, the process of separating the consumer from the person who is selling the services. Since that time, the market has just gotten more and more complex, and there's more and more payers in the market, which is added to the complexity as well. But I would all put it back to insurance. And anytime you're not actually looking at the actual cost and paying attention, you're more likely to not pay attention to the costs. We often see this happen to young adults when they get their first credit card, that they're very excited about the spending power that they have, and they sometimes forget the responsibility that they have to keep an eye on it. And, you know, what I'm hoping to do through this bill is to try to at least put a little more light on the cost of healthcare. And I think that there are other ways that we can do that as well, and I look forward to advancing other bills that approach it from a different tack, but perhaps a similar issue of trying to present more light in the issue.
Follow-up, Representative Easton.
Thank you. Now, I think you're on the right track as far as insurance has certainly made things much less transparent. I'm wondering, since most of, I think, the consumers of healthcare in Alaska that we'll be talking about, you know, do fall under some kind of either private or government-sponsored, you know, healthcare program, and it is, you know, insurance that we're dealing with. It's basically setting those costs. Have you considered, rather than approaching it like this, just, you know, kind of hitting it dead on and going after the insurance cost side of things and saying, you know, if you're going to offer insurance, you know, you need to have transparency in the prices that you're dealing with. Have you considered that, and what did you conclude?
I have, and that may be another bill for another day. Representative Eastman.
Further follow-up, Representative Eastman?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Representative Reinbold, I think I saw you.
Yes, you
okay.
Did.
Go ahead.
I would like to just briefly answer Representative Eastman's with your indulgence. I spent about 15 years in healthcare, so I'd like to just quickly respond. I used to be operations manager of Medical Park Family Care, and I cannot tell you how difficult it is to try to quote a price when someone calls. For example, they'll say they have a sore throat, or really they have much, much more complicated issues that they're not comfortable telling the person that they're making the appointment with. And then once they get in the back room, five or six other issues might come up, and requiring a shot or requiring this or requiring that. So it's extremely complicated. I know vaccine charges change all the time. They're constantly changing. Also, insurance plans are changing regularly. Sometimes people come in for veterans, sometimes TRICARE, sometimes they come in with a car accident. Well, it took us years to get car a lot of times, so we charged a different if it was a car, an auto accident, or a worker's comp, or a contract that they might have with the unions, you know, or state employees. I mean, it was constantly, it literally would take about 15 minutes to interrogate a patient of asking all the different questions when they're making an appointment to try to figure out what fee schedule that we were supposed to use. Sometimes the comprehensive exams, we had to do 20 different things for when we had the contract. I'm just saying it's so much more complicated than what meets the eye, and as she says, there's about 10. It's not that I'm saying this is a bad or good idea. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it is so complicated to quote a price because you don't know how complicated that patient is and until they show up or what kind of parameters of depending on whether they're Medicaid or whatever when they show up. And there's very different issues to deal with each and every individual patient.
Well,
and I will appreciate those comments. I will note that that's pretty far afield from what this bill does.
He asked.
I understand. It's fine. And I let you go ahead. That's fine. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? I don't see any others at this point. As I noted before, we are going to hold this bill. We will hear it again on Wednesday. If you have amendments, they must be in by 5 o'clock. And the goal,
Tuesday.
5 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday, the 28th of March. And so the goal will be to move this bill from the committee on Wednesday. Representative Christ Tompkins, a quick comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to thank you and the sponsor for the conversations on this, and also note my appreciation to OSHNA for getting this top 50 most common CPT codes. I mean, it's really helpful to sort of give us a sense of, at least for larger facilities, what this bill might end up looking like, albeit hopefully with plain English descriptions.
Yes.
And I will note it is interesting in all the confusion of price from hospital number one and unidentified hospital, it is noteworthy that the complete blood count, something that all of us have had probably more than once in our life, that's the most common procedure, and so that's something we probably can learn something from. Our second order of business is House Bill 42, Forfeiture and Seizure Procedure and Limits, which is sponsored by Representative Wilson. This is the fourth hearing of the bill. Last week, we adopted a committee substitute as our working document, and Director John Skidmore from the Department of Law walked us through the bill, and Mr. Skidmore is actually with us today and not just on the phone. At this time, I would like to move on to amendments. As a reminder to members, the maker of the amendment will make a motion. If no one objects, the amendment passes. If there is an objection, the member will speak to the amendment. Then, if the objection is maintained, the amendment will be put to a vote. I submitted amendments 1 through 4, so at this time I'm going to pass the gavel to my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler, to take up the to manage the chair as we go through the amendments 1 through 4.
Okay, thank you. May I have a motion to bring the First Amendment before this committee?
I move amendment number 1.
All right, is there any objection?
Objection for purposes of discussion.
Objection for discussion.
Excuse me, do you have all of the amendments here?
No, I'm going to have to go get a copy.
Hang tight. We're getting.
Take a brief at ease while we wait for amendments to come. Back on the record.
So amendment number 1 responds to the discussion that took place at our last committee meeting with regard to on page 5, subsection C, which addressed the topic of returning seized property to the owner of that property and trying to figure out a way both to address the challenge that sometimes evidence has no evidentiary value, but other times the evidence actually has continuing evidentiary value, but there's ways to reach a stipulation or agreement that will allow the value of the evidence to be shown in court without the evidence. Perfect example being pictures of the article, and if the defendant agrees to waive any objections they might have to not having the evidence present, there would be a way for returning that property. And then the other part of amendment number 1 is it sets it out so that the court has the option but not a mandatory requirement to ask the owner of the property to post cash or a monetary bond that would be the up to the value of that property to, again, provide security for the value of that property should the property not get returned at the end of the case.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Are we on the CS?
Yes.
Yes. It should be / E.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Klayman, anything further or any questions for Representative Klayman or discussion on amendment number 1? Representative Eastman.
I was curious what the sponsor's thoughts, if any, are on amendment number 1. Do we know?
The sponsor, it's a committee bill now.
No. All right, fair enough. Originally it started off as a bill sponsored by a representative. I was curious if they had any thoughts on the amendment.
And Representative Wilson's staff is here. I believe that Representative Wilson advised my office that she was comfortable with all these amendments. But you can ask her staff. She's nodding her head.
Would you like to come up and say something officially on the record? That way we can just have it read in.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Barbara Barnes, staff for Representative Tammy Wilson, District 3, North Pole. The sponsor has no objections for this.
Thank you.
And Ms. Barnes, before you leave, is that true as well with the other proffered amendments for this, so we don't have to keep calling you up each day?
No, some of those, I'm sorry, through the chair, some of those amendments that are there obviously are somewhat duplicative, and I presume that the committee will wash those out, but Representative Wilson has said, the sponsor has no objections to the amendments in the will of the committee.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion regarding amendment number one? Do you maintain your objection, Representative Eastman?
I do not.
Okay, so we now have no objection, and it doesn't seem like anyone else is going to object. So with that, amendment number one is adopted. And we have a motion to move amendment number two.
Move amendment number two.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Representative Klayman, can you explain what amendment number two does?
So what amendment number two does is, prior to what is in section 1235.220, which is pages 4 and 5 of the CS, that provides a mechanism for all property to be returned, not just firearms. And 12.36.060 is a specific provision that relates to the return of firearms. And so the purpose of this amendment, wait a minute, I may be confusing amendments. That's right. The purposes of this amendment is to add section 320, which we just referenced, to the remission of firearms, and then later in the section we repeal section 1236050 that was a specific provision relating to remission of property. And that's probably not the most clear description of what this does. Did you follow that, or did I lose you?
Sorry, you lost me.
Okay.
But I have a question that might help clarify.
Representative Eastman.
Or at least you can add it to your answer, perhaps. Can you just talk to us about what 320 is? Since we're basically replacing 50 with 320, and 320 doesn't appear in the amendment.
So 320 is the provision that provides for the remission of forfeited property as well as seized property. And 1236050, which is what you see on the last page of amendment number two, is a separate provision in the statutes, and it's a separate provision in the statute that relates to the remission of forfeited property. And the analysis showed that we were actually now, by enacting the portion that is the 1236320, we are essentially doing the same thing that takes place in 1236050, but expanding the scope of the return of forfeited property. And so the advice from Ledge Legal was that keeping 1236050 duplicated what we were doing in 1236320. And then what goes on in 1236060 is now replacing 1236050 with 1236320, which is what we are enacting. And so it, in broad terms, what Amendment 2 does is it takes on a specific provision as to one type of property in 1236050 and replaces it with what is now 320 that is broader in scope for the return of property.
I'm really mixed up.
This is really complicated.
Representative Kopp.
So my understanding of what Amendment 2 does is it takes the explanation offered currently in 1236050 of the findings of fact that are necessary for a forfeited weapon to be returned. And it takes those same findings of fact and it says these are necessary for any property to be returned to avoid duplicate references in the law, not just a section just for weapons, but for any property that's sought to be returned to the owner. 1236.320 in this bill covers all property, including weapons, and so it's a legal's way of expanding that standard we have for owners to get guns back to all property. Is that, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ledoux.
Well, we don't seem to have 1236050. I don't think is actually in this new bill. But I guess I'm just wondering if that's the reason, if 050 is everything except weapons, then why don't we just add weapons to 050 instead of making 050 everything except weapons? Maybe it would be just easier to include weapons in 050 to undo the exclusion. Thank you.
Can Much Legal talk to us?
Mr. Chairman.
Let's go Rep. Yeah. Kopp, then Rep. Reinbold.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Representative Ledoux, we don't want to exclude weapons from 050. All 050 is about is just weapons. That's all it's about, is remitting a weapon. So, what the amendment does is it simply says those findings of fact that have to be made by the court to give that back to the owner apply to all property that an owner claiming interest in. That's the standard that has to be met for the property to be returned.
Representative Ledoux.
So if this is the standard for everything, weapons are not weapons, why isn't it just all in what? Deadly weapons. Okay, so 050 includes relates to weapons, correct? But it doesn't relate to all weapons. It just relates to a firearm or ammunition. Is that what 050 is about?
Just related to guns, yes.
Okay. So why not just make 1236050 relate to all deadly weapons instead of putting in two sections for it?
Representative Clayman, it looks like you might want to take a stab at this.
The goal in 320 is to expand it not just to firearms and deadly weapons, to all property. So it isn't a question of we would need to. Well, first, Ledge Legal didn't seem to want to do it with 050, but that's the first part of the answer. But the second part of the answer is 320 would expand it to all types of property. The areas that are very concerned in forfeiture being planes, boats, automobiles, they would be covered by 320. And not, and because they cover all those kinds of property, it would also apply to firearms and deadly weapons, whereas 050 is a much more limited rescission of property statute. So I think Ledge Legal, I think the way this started was they started drafting a section for rescission of property about boats, planes, and automobiles, and then in the course of working on it, we realized that there was a statute about guns and that we should remove the statute about guns and all put it into what was being drafted for the bill. That was probably the sequence that led us where we are.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Reimel.
Not that I don't trust any of you, but can we ask Ledge Legal what the heck Amendment Number 2 does?
If they're on the phone.
They are?
If they are, I'm not sure they are.
Okay. Why don't we try to get them on the phone? Is there other discussion outside of the Ledge Legal question regarding Amendment Number 2? All right. Okay.
We're all watching okay. You. You got a leash on. You got a leash on.
I'm just going to do 3 and 4, and then we'll come back to 2. That's fine. So my intention here is I'm going to... sorry. Representative Eastman.
Sorry, just wanted to make sure I'm tracking everything the committee's tracking. So under Amendment 2, you know, the section that we're dealing with here in Section 10 does specifically deal with deadly weapons, and we're simply bringing 320, which doesn't one of the amendments or the bill do something to change 320? Or are we simply saying 320 is great as is, unamended, unchanged, and now we want it to cover deadly weapons also?
I believe Amendment 4 and also Amendment 6 speak to 320.
Great. Thank you.
So, okay. Any other questions from the committee at this time? Okay, we're going to just hold on to that. We'll take these out of order. Can I have a motion to move Amendment Number 3?
I'll move Amendment Number 3.
Are there any objections?
Object for discussion.
Almost that was made.
All right. Representative Klayman, can you explain what Amendment Number 3 does?
Yes, Amendment Number 3... Part of what was recommended in the bill was to no longer provide a list of every single offense that had a forfeiture provision within Title 12, Chapter 36, but instead just make a reference to laws and regulations that involve forfeiture. And by adding language that doesn't list the offenses, which was the list of offenses is under 1236.310, if there's just a reference to the statutes themselves, then there's no longer a need to have 1236.310 where the statutes would be listed separately, which would tend to create lots of revisers' bills in the years ahead if we were supposed to list every offense that was subject to forfeiture, so that the purpose in trying to reduce the number of words in the statutes was to just reference offenses that had forfeiture provisions and take out 310, and that's the purpose of Amendment Number 3.
Any other discussion regarding Amendment Number 3?
I just need one more minute just to think about this.
Okay.
So this has nothing to do with a list being collected of the list that they took. It's simply listing the laws, regulations, and ordinances. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Ryan.
Okay. All right.
Any further discussion on Amendment Number 3? Seeing none, is the objection maintained regarding Amendment Number 3?
No.
Okay. Hearing no objection, Amendment Number 3 is now adopted. Representative Klayman, would you like to move Amendment Number 4?
I'll move Amendment Number 4.
All right.
And then to make matters slightly more confusing.
Is there an objection?
I'll object.
Well, actually...
He objects to his own amendment first.
But before you get to the full amendment, I will note that the Department of Law contacted us this morning with some additional change they would like to Amendment Number 4. So after discussions with Department of Law you should be getting now a handwritten Amendment A to Amendment Number 4. And rather than try to deal with these in serial, I would move Amendment A to Amendment Number 4 so that the discussion can address both of these.
Do I object so you can talk about it?
Sure.
Okay. So we have a motion to move Amendment 4A, A to Amendment Number 4.
Okay, I'm not going to object moving the amendment.
Okay.
So
there's no objection.
There's no objection. Now Amendment 4 now includes what you have on this paper and also what we were just distributed, Amendment A.
I'm only objecting so we can talk about it.
Well, you'll
not
be
moving it.
Yeah, but you'll hear the whole amendment with A added.
Tell me when, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
So now we still have an objection to Amendment Number 4.
Okay.
As amended.
As amended. Oh.
Could we take an Addies for just a
second? Brief Addies. Back, and we now have Amendment 4 as amended with Amendment A. Do I have an objection to that?
Objection.
Okay. Now, Representative Klayman, would you like to speak to the new amended Amendment 4?
So Amendment 4A, or Amendment 4 as amended with A, speaks to the concerns that came up in committee at our last meeting regarding Section 1236.320 regarding remission of forfeited property, which is what Representative Eastman was asking. Is 320 left alone, or is it getting some changes? So this is the change to 320. And the concern that came up at the committee meeting last time was, what about somebody who receives property by gift or by inheritance, and how should that impact this whole analysis of whether they can get their property back? And what became apparent in discussions with Department of Law after our meeting was that the committee was very focused on what happens to property that was gifted before the crime occurred. So my example was, my grandfather gave me his favorite pistol, and then 2 years later somebody steals it from the house, and unbeknownst to me, they use it in a crime. So that's the pre-crime transmission of property. And the Department of Law had a very different concern than members of the committee. They were very concerned with the post-crime transfer of property, where people are transferring property to try to conceal that property and avoid its being forfeited for a variety of reasons. And so it became apparent in trying to address the gift and inheritance issue that we needed to both address the pre-crime transfer of property by gift or inheritance, as well as not allow that to be a basis upon which one could avoid forfeiture of property for post-crime transfers of property. And so the amendment in number 4 addresses those issues. The first thing that happens in amendment number 4, because of questions in subsection 4 on page 7, line 7, about was a bona fide purchaser for fair value, we realize that the term more commonly used is fair market value, so that market is added into the bona fide purchaser for value. And then the next thing that we do is we add in a new subsection C, which will go ahead of the current subsection C. And this is the subsection that's designed to address concerns with inheritance and gifts. And this incorporates Amendment A, which the late concern from the Department of Law is that they felt, even in the gift situation, it was important to have the concepts in subsections 1 through 3 regarding legal right to the property, did not knowingly participate in the commission of the crime, and did not know that the property was used in the crime, that those needed to be added into the gift and inheritance language. So the way amendment, the what the new subsection C would provide is, first, the court would have to find by preponderance of the evidence that 1236.320A, subsections 1 through 3, but not subsection 4, are proven, and that's by preponderance of the evidence. And then the court would have the option that they could, it's not a required, but may order the remission of the property if the property was conveyed by gift or inheritance. And there's an exemption note in the gift that it has to come from a person other than the defendant. So that's an effort to address the gift inheritance situation and both address the concerns that were coming to both the pre-crime gift or inheritance as well as the post-crime. More likely, the post-crime would be more likely a gift than an inheritance, because, of course, if the post-crime was an inheritance, then the defendant presumably isn't around to be charged with the crime. So gift is more about the post-crime. So that's Amendment 4 as amended.
Discussion. Representative Reinbold.
I want to say thanks for fixing that. That was an important issue we spent quite a bit of time on, so I appreciate that.
We spent a lot of time on it. We're going to the language.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, thanks for the explanation. So that helps me understand part of it. I'm still not entirely sure how the amended portion of Amendment 4 is beneficial. Can you talk specifically to the amended portion?
I can speak to it, and if my explanation doesn't get you all the way there, then the Department of Law, who suggested that we have two here, and I'm sure they can walk you through it as well. The concern that the Department of Law raised, and in reviewing it, I thought it made sense, that there were circumstances that could arise in which there are circumstances that could arise in which a person could give the property and they shouldn't be able to get away with it. And the example is, my mother gifts me a car and I loan it to a friend of mine who I happen to know is a bit of a ne'er-do-well, and I know that person has a tendency to commit crimes in vehicles. And if I've actually loaned the car to my friend who has a tendency to commit crimes in vehicles and that person goes out and commits crimes in vehicles, I should not qualify as an innocent owner and be able to get my property back because I was foolish enough to give it to my friend who tended to do those things. And so that amendment adds in subsections 1 through 3 that really basically means I've got to show that I'm an innocent owner or the equivalent of an innocent owner, and I'm not somebody that's kind of gaming the system.
So the amendment ends with an ellipse. What actually takes the place of the ellipse? That's what I'm trouble understanding.
I'm just making it, if you look at the two, the if the court finds language would come just after subsection C, the letter C.
The new C or the old C?
Well, look at Amendment 4.
Okay.
And the C on Amendment 4 on the page on the amendment. So immediately after the C in the brackets, the language would read, if the court finds by preponderance of the evidence that AS 1236.320, 1 through 3 are proven, comma, the court may order the remission of property. And the reason I put comma and then wrote D with a small case T is because on the page it's a capital T. And so that's an indication that you put in the and then you continue on, the court may order the remission of property conveyed.
Ah.
Okay.
I get it now. I did not understand that previously. Okay. Got it.
Representative Reinbold.
I'm sorry for getting into the weeds on this one, but it says if the court finds a preponderance of evidence, is there a reason why we didn't use any other word than that? Because isn't that like the highest level of...
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, it's actually tracking the language in 1236.320A. Preponderance isn't the highest level of evidence. There's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, so it's beyond reasonable doubt. Go ahead.
There's beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest standard. Clear and convincing evidence is the next highest standard. Preponderance of the evidence, which is typically the civil standard, and actually in terms of evidentiary findings, I think for those are the only three standards that get involved. And I'm seeing Director Skidmore is nodding his head. Apparently I managed to get it right.
Okay, so beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest, did you say?
Yes.
And then clear and convincing, and then preponderance?
Correct.
Okay, then I'm good with this. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Kopp.
So I support the amendment, but I am surprised that in the wording of this, it when you look at subsection B, and I apologize for not thinking of this before, but subsection B there on line 6, page 7, says, upon a showing that the person is entitled to relief under A of this section. So it seems to me that all of Amendment 4 could be just dropped in right there. The court may order that, and then you go right down through this amendment. The court may order, because A has to be proven, and we've just said it in line B, upon a showing that the person is entitled to relief under A. That's what we're saying in this Amendment 4 is amended, mm-hmm. to under A of this section. And then you go right into Amendment 4. The court may order the admission of property conveyed by 1, 2, and then what we have there in B now should be number 3. And that, to me, seems like it would just flow logically, and we wouldn't have broken up showing things that have to be proved under A first under two different subsections.
Representative Kopp, I would just note.
Actually, I should wait. It's okay to respond.
Yes, Representative Klayman, you may respond.
I think that the challenge with B is B doesn't address what drove Amendment 4 was the issue of gifts and inheritance. And B doesn't really address the gift and inheritance issue.
It would if we inserted that language there. It says the court may order, just taking your language there, right after the word section on line 7, the court may order the remission of property conveyed by 1, inheritance to an individual who is not a party to the offense resulting in forfeiture, 2, gift from a person other than the defendant, or 3, would be... okay.
I'm gonna, I bet they're on a lifeline to one of the lawyers from the Department of Law.
Okay, if we can have Director Skidmore come up, and then in our discussion we'll have Representative Eastman will be next after this point.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Director for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. To answer the question posed by Representative Kopp, the problem, I believe, with trying to fold what's happening with Amendment 4 in with subsection B of the bill as currently drafted under version U is that subsection B is addressing the fact that there is a posting of money for the property when it's released. That's a different concept than what's in Amendment 4. Amendment 4 is attempting to address the ability for property to be returned if it's an inheritance or a gift, and there have not been the concerns raised in subsections 1 through 3 of sub A. I hope that makes sense. I can try it in language without all the subsections, if that helps.
That's all right, Mr. Chairman. I'm fine with your amendment, Mr. Chairman, but I'm not convinced by the explanation. I think it logically flows perfectly. All four of those would drop right in there. You have to find A, and just like what you have said, the court ordering an amount equal to the value of the person's interest be paid to the person, or that the property be released to the person, A must be found. A1, 2, and 3 must be found. So A1, 2, and 3 must be found for all of your amendment, too. Maybe that's just stylistic. You have a good amendment. And I just
recognize that I'm at an age where if I don't have it in print in front of me, I have a hard time tracking
that's,
it.
So. That's fine, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
It's already been said. Thank you.
I will take an indulgence, if I may. I definitely recognize the need for this, but I guess I still see several situations in here that may automatically disqualify someone from getting property back. One would be a situation where you purchase something that's not at fair market value, where you have a situation that's not quite a gift, but at the same point, not the fair market value. So, for instance, perhaps if parents sold someone, you know, a daughter or son a car for an extremely reduced price. It's not quite a gift. They haven't played fair market value. Someone takes that car and uses it in the commission of the crime, and now they can't get it back because they're falling in this Netherlands. Is it, can you speak to that, maybe, perhaps Representative Klayman or Director Skidmore or whoever?
I'm happy to address it if you'd like me to.
Sure.
Representative Fansler, I don't think your scenario would actually present a problem, because last week when the committee had the concerns, or I think it was last week, the last time the committee heard the bill, the concerns that had been presented dealt with that bona fide purchaser for fair value. And the amendment, which Representative Klayman has offered, amendment number 4, says that you have to comply with 1, 2, and 3, but not number 4. So the fair market value is no longer an issue for the court to decide if the person has the legal right or interest in the property. So my uncle sells me his Ferrari for $50. I now hold legal right to it, even though I didn't pay a fair market value under sub 1. I loan my Ferrari to my friend Jeff, not knowing that Jeff's going to use it in the commission of the crime. Well, I can still get my car back. I can still get my Ferrari back. Jeff uses it in that, and I had no reason to know that Jeff would use it in the commission of that crime. Then I can still get the car back. I don't have to establish now that I paid fair market value for the Ferrari from my uncle. So that's what Amendment 4 was designed to do, was to eliminate that rationale of the fair market value is having to be established.
So if you're falling under this, though, then the new rationale that we're adding in, it says, must be an inheritance to an individual who was not a party to the offense resulting in forfeiture, or a gift from a person other than the defendant. And that's now our two new requirements replacing 4.
So to answer your, and forgive me, I don't mean to cut you off, but to answer your question, when my uncle allows me to purchase the Ferrari for $50, and we're assuming that Ferrari still drives, and therefore it's going to be well above $50.
Not the like the one in my bank.
Assuming that that's where you are, there is some aspect of that that remains a gift. A gift doesn't have to be I give it to you and you don't pay me anything for it. A gift is that I'm giving you something for which I haven't gotten fair market value. So even when I am paying less than fair market value, that is still a gift that my uncle is giving to me. So, and it's not adding two of them. It's one or the other, because the or is used in, under Amendment 4, subsection C1. There's an or at the end of that before you get to 2, which is the gift. So there's still a, that Ferrari is in some aspect a gift to me. And so long as I don't know that, I think the name I used was Fred, so long as I don't know that Fred was using it in a crime, or that I had reason to believe Fred was going to use that Ferrari in a crime, I get my Ferrari back.
And I'll follow up with two other scenarios. I know this is not the way to go through this, I guess, sometimes. But could you speak to perhaps an instance where it's not intended to be a gift? So maybe in what we're talking about here, I can understand where you could argue, hey, my parents gifted me this car's value and just made me pay the $50 for the Ferrari. But what happens in the situation where perhaps you you buy something, let's say, go back to the antique gun situation that we had. You go to a, you know, you go to a yard sale in your community, and somebody sells you this gun that you pay something, you know, $100 for, and its real value, since it's an antique or since it's something like that, is much greater than that. And they didn't knowingly sell it to you with the intention of gifting it to you. It just was a not known kind of situation.
Understand. And in that scenario, I turn back to Alaska Statute 1146-980 that talks about the market value of the property at the time and place in which the crime occurred. And what's
really talking about in that statute is the value of the property that's stolen. But the point that I'm making is that the fair value of the property is not if everybody knows absolutely everything there is to know about that piece of property at the time it's sold. It's I, as the seller, think that I'm getting a fair return for the property that I have. And if I don't realize that I'm holding that Ming Vase, that rare antique gun, that thing that take what have you, that has greater value than what you recognize, and you sell it for that, that's the fair market value. Shame on the seller for not having realized there was a Van Gogh below that picture of the dogs playing poker.
And then I guess just the final one that I would say, and this is more for the committee to think about. So it says gift from a person other than the defendant. So that means if the defendant gifts this to you, say 20 years earlier, you know, and then turns around later and steals it from you and uses it in the commission of a crime, even though you're an innocent party who's done the three things, didn't knowingly, you know, holds legal right title, did not knowingly participate in the commission of the crime, and did not have reasonable cause to believe, you still can't receive it back because it was the defendant that gifted it to you. So I don't know if there's many situations that would fall under with that, but there could be, I guess, in my mind. So
I think I understand the proposition that you are suggesting, that a defendant gifts property to another person and then obtains that property to use in the commission of a crime, and the person to whom they gifted it to, you're suggesting the state's going to seek forfeiture from that person simply because the defendant took it back to use it in the crime. To me, it's not that it was given to you by the defendant. To me, what matters are subsections 1, 2, and 3, that the person actually had the property, had legal right to the property, that they didn't knowingly participate in the commission of the offense, and they did not know or have reason to believe that the property would be used to commit a crime. That's actually the exact same language, to go back to the previous discussion the committee had about eliminating the statute that dealt only with weapons. Those same three concepts are the exact same three concepts that are in that other statute. Those are the exact same three concepts that are found in statute, that we want to make sure that when the person is using whatever property it is in the commission of the crime, the person that they took it from or that loaned it to them didn't realize that's how it would be used. Those are the key elements, not who actually gave it to the property. Does that make sense?
It does, but I just see the from the gift from a person part in there that gives me a little bit of heartburn. But
I understand that, and what I'm suggesting is that if the committee wanted to eliminate that last portion of it, that doesn't change the analysis for the Department of Law. So if you have heartburn over that, that's a policy decision, and you can eliminate that. What remains important is to keep those first three sections, is what I'm describing.
Okay. I'll cede the floor here to Representative Eastman, then Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm listening to the discussion, which often goes back to line 5, which is 4, dealing with fair market value. And so, you know, we've really pulled quite a bit out of 4 in our amendment we're looking at currently by stepping away from it. It seems to me that 4 is not especially helpful, whether we step away from it or not. And if you look back to 1, we already talk about the fact that it must have been acquired in good faith. And then we proceed to deal with 4 and try and reestablish that it was that it was acquired in good faith and that the price was, you know, appropriate and so forth. You know, if I was a judge looking at this and we've already established that it was acquired in good faith, I'm not sure that 4 is needed.
Representative Ledoux.
I'm so confused here. But let's, if you go to 4, or page 7, line 5, paren 4, and now it's reading was a bona fide purchaser for fair market value. Why don't you just put after was a bona fide purchaser for fair market value, or inherited the property from an individual who is not a party to the offense resulting in forfeiture, or the property was a gift. Why wouldn't that be the simplest way of doing this?
And through the chair, I do note that we have Hillary Martin on the line now from Ledge Legal. And that was their recommendation of how to deal with the problem.
What, the way it is right now?
What is Amendment 4, yes.
What is Amendment number 4? Well, maybe Ms. Martin can tell me why the language that I just have posed doesn't solve the problem in a simpler way.
Ms. Martin, can you hear us?
Yeah, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services.
And can you address, did you hear the proposed possible, you know, language that Representative Ledoux said?
Yes, I did. Through the chair, if the proposed language that is in Amendment number 4, I think it could easily be added into page 7, line 5, because if you're already keeping the language, you already have the preponderance of the evidence and you want 1, 2, and 3 of A to apply, you could rewrite 4 so that it says either bona fide purchaser for fair value inherited the property or was gifted the property from someone other than the defendant.
Representative Ledoux, since this is yours, I'll let you go, and then Representative Eastman,
okay,
right after that.
Would it have to be inherited the property from, it was a gift from somebody other than the defendant, when Mr. Skidmore has just told us, I think, that it doesn't matter whether it came from the defendant or not, if I understood correctly?
Through the chair, you did.
That's a decision for the committee to make. I was just going with what was currently in Amendment number 4.
Representative Ledoux, follow up?
No, it was just a suggestion.
Representative Eastman.
Yes, Ms. Martin. Perhaps you heard my brief comment prior to Representative Ledoux. So I understand the requirement in Parent 4 dealing with fair market value to relate directly to whether or not the property was acquired in good faith. And I'm looking at Section 4 and Section 1 here as more or less accomplishing the same thing. What do I lose if I simply eliminate the portion of text here which says, you know, was a bona fide purchaser for fair market value?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, without that requirement, you're just removing that the person has to have purchased it for fair value. The other 1, 2, and 3 would still apply. That's a decision for the committee whether they want to require a bona fide purchaser for fair value.
Well, it would seem to me that might also, in addition to making it shorter, might render a lot of the things that we're talking about right now not necessary to work through.
Okay. Representative Clayman, do you?
Mr. Skidmore had
a
comment on this, and I will defer.
If I may. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the significance of the bona fide purchaser for fair market value deals with the scenario in which I'm the defendant, and I think this goes back to the crux of what Representative Clayman was talking about, that you as a committee are focused at the exchange of the property prior to the commission of the offense. We as prosecutors are more interested in what's happening after the offense has occurred. And so if I commit the crime, and I've used, let's use the gun, just because that's the example that people seem to like. If I use the gun, and after I've committed the crime, I turn to my friend Fred and say, Fred, I want to give you this $5,000 gun, but I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to let you buy it from me for $100. There's nothing that says that's not in good faith.
I can argue that various things that might get me there in good faith. But what I've really done is I have tried to divest myself, to give away that property, give it to somebody else so that it's no longer subject to forfeiture. So I give it to Fred. I sell it to Fred. I shouldn't say give. I sell it to Fred for far less than it's worth. And if nobody's able to prove that I've done that inappropriately, judgment gets passed, piece of property isn't forfeited, and a year, 2 years later, I go back to Fred. And that gun that I allowed Fred to purchase for $100, I come back and I say, I'm willing to give you $2,000 for it. Remember, it's worth $5,000. Fred just made a hell of an investment there, just earned a lot of money off of that. And I've gotten back the very item that I was trying to prevent from being taken. Now, the gun, it only halfway gets you there. Let me paint the picture of why forfeiture is actually so important and so powerful in law enforcement. It's not the gun that I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of the fishing vessel, the airplane, that's altered. It's altered in a way to allow it to be used for the criminal circumstances. Let me give it a modern day, I don't know if literature is the right term or not, but are you familiar with Star Wars and the Millennium Falcon? You know how Han Solo altered the Millennium Falcon to enable him to smuggle goods in the Millennium Falcon? That's what we see people do. They alter planes, they alter bolts, they alter something else, so that then the value of that item isn't how much is it worth, it's this is allowing me to engage in this illegal conduct, and so it has that extra value to me. And the case law that we find that discusses forfeiture and the value of forfeiture is that it ensures that whatever item has been altered to allow it to be used for those illegal purposes is taken out of the marketplace. It can no longer be used for those illegal purposes. So that's really what we're trying to get to, is sometimes there is a particular piece of property. It's not the value of the property that we're concerned about as law enforcement. It's the fact that it's been altered to allow it to be used for an illegal purpose. And we want to remove that property that's been altered so that it's enhanced for that illegal purpose. We want to remove that from the marketplace, from any criminal being able to continue to use it in that manner. And so when we talk about the bona fide purchaser, what we're really trying to make sure of is that it's not this shell game of what happens with the property, that it somehow slid to somebody else and they say, oh, no, that's legally mine now, and you can't take it from me. I didn't know that they were going, right, because it's done afterwards. So it's not knowingly participated. I didn't participate in the crime. Didn't know or have reason to believe that the property was used. I had no idea that Han was using the Millennium Falcon for that purchase. I just needed a ship. You know, I heard it ran the fastest parsecs, whatever that line is from the movie that they talk about, right? It's that same concept. I'm just saying that I wanted that particular ship. But we need to remove that ship from the marketplace because it's now been altered just for purposes of smuggling. And, you know, it's sort of humorous. People kind of laugh when we talk about the Millennium Falcon. But we've actually had cases in which there were fishing vessels that were altered to hide the catches that were taken in. We've had airplanes altered so that they could be used for illegal purposes in hunting or fishing. Those are the sorts of things that we're concerned about. And that's why the bona fide purchaser remains important, at least from a law enforcement perspective.
Representative Eastman, follow-up.
Okay, so some thoughts on this. I like the analogy. At the same time, I don't think anything we're doing with this language, either as it's currently in statute or as the amendments describe, is going to, you know, really limit the ability of the courts, you know, working with the information provided by law enforcement, that, you know, is going to change the fact about whether or not we have, you know, the fair market value of an item changes when it's modified or, you know, rendered for smuggling purposes or something else. So, I mean, we can say that the fair market value changes, but I go back to acquired in good faith. There's nothing in any of the language we're discussing that keeps a product which the court has returned back to a party from being sold by that party back to whomever sold it, you know, at some point after the state, you know, has given that property back to another party. It, it kind of seems like we're talking about stopping something, but nothing in the language we're discussing is going to keep that activity from happening. At some point, if you know the state remits the property, then what happens to that property afterwards, you know, the state doesn't really have a lot to do with. And if it was acquired in good faith, then, you know, the state, I mean, that's really seems to be the interest. And if, you know, if we establish that it's, you know, a tool used by smugglers, then maybe the in good faith part comes into question there. I mean, it would seem to me that it would be very hard not to have that come into question, because you're now obtaining something which the state is you know, showing is used for illegal activities. Isn't that the whole reason that we have the good faith language in the statute?
Any further discussion here on amendment number 4? I'm not seeing any. Okay. Who had the original objection to this? Is that Representative?
Right.
Do you?
I think it was me.
Okay. Do you maintain the objection?
I just want. Do you just mind if there's any other. You already asked everybody if there was any other issues, then I'll remove my objection if there's no further issues.
Sure. Representative Eastman.
I'm continuing to be more convinced that we ought just to get rid of the fourth portion here, and that by getting rid of the fourth portion, we obviate the need for a lot of the things we're talking in the Fourth Amendment and the amendment to the Fourth Amendment.
Okay.
No, we're good.
Do you mind if I respond to
that? Yes, Representative Reimold.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I thought there was an important issue that we brought up during the committee several days ago that I thought we were all in agreement on, and that's why I think it needs to be addressed. Whether this is a perfect amendment, it's still to be decided, but I guess I'm going to yield to either the carrier of the bill or the chairman or a committee member to decide what to do. Because okay. I probably should maintain my objection if there's issues at this time.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I'm supporting the philosophy of the amendment, but I'm still not sure that we've got the right language for the amendment.
Further discussion?
I'll just note that what is amendment number 4 went through a tremendous number of iterations before we agreed on that, and it was with a coordination with different members of the committee as well as the Department of Law and Ledge Legal, and I recognize that many of your observations suggest that it may be less than a perfect solution, but it's the solution we have before us. I think we'd have to vote down the amendment and potentially come back another day and continue to debate this if we can't live with Amendment 4. I think too complicated to start again with more of a. I mean, if that's the committee's will, I certainly will continue to work on it, because it's a committee bill, and I see that as a fair thing to do if we want to bring it back another day.
Well,
Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'm just not really comfortable with the language, and I think this is the last. This isn't going anyplace else, is it?
Finance.
Well, but finance, through the chair, really wants us to do the substantive work on this.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Kopp.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think that the sum total of the language of the CS version U in front of us, as Representative Eastman has pointed out, it very clearly identifies that a person seeking remission of the person's interest, their interest in the property, you have to show that you have legal right, title, or interest. So that's covered, that person did not knowingly participate in the commission of the crime in which the property was used, which the Millennium Falcon was used. That's covered. And they did not know or have reasonable cause to believe that the property was used or would be used to commit a crime. That's covered. And then with the amendment, we get rid of the problem of the language saying, and you have to show that you were a bona fide purchaser for fair market value. Now, by adding this subsection to say that the court, in those situations where it's inheritance or a gift, the court may still order the remission of property if you were not a party to the offense resulting in forfeiture, or it was given to you as a gift from someone other than the defendant. So I think it we may be a little windy, but I think we get at something conceptually that arrives us to protecting people's rights, allowing certainly anybody who can at least make a case to the court that they're an innocent party to do so. So that's my comment. I think still the word and on line 4, page 7, troubles me when we are still tying all four of those things together, and was a bona fide purchaser for fair market value. I'm not sure why we have to have an and there, but I think because you can certainly have 1 through 3 and 4 not apply, you can still have your legal right, title, or interest and not have been a bona fide purchaser. If this new subsection cures that, then it looks to me like it does. It specifically addresses inheritance and gifts. I'm trying to think if there's any other way you can get property. I mean, tooth fairy, I don't know, but or somebody transfers something to you. Is that a gift? Because something is transferred to you. Families transfer property to each other's names. Fishermen will transfer permits sometimes, maybe even boats. I don't know.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're trying very hard to get very particular language, and I think we're getting to the point of maybe being overly litigious. I would much rather give the courts some discretion, and so that's why I'm not real comfortable with what we have currently. It also strikes to me, and I'll just point out for the sake of the litigious side of the conversation, if an individual should happen to be in the unfortunate circumstance of having paid for greater than fair market value, they wouldn't be caught up by any of this, because it's certainly not a gift if you're paying for more than the fair market value. So even as we try to tighten our fists with the language, the star systems are falling through our fingers yet again.
Representative Ledoux.
I think it's like really difficult to try to draft this language in a committee hearing. I guess what I'd suggest is that you appoint whoever wants to work on this language to a subcommittee to come back here on Wednesday or Friday with the appropriate language.
Okay. Representative Klayman.
I think this actually doesn't, the language doesn't address Representative Eastman's issues about fair market value, but as we've heard from the prosecutor's office, they have problems with eliminating the fair market value language. I think that the language as drafted addresses the concerns that the committee has. I certainly recognize it's not perfect. If the committee votes down the amendment, then I think we go back to work on it.
Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Okay. Then can I get a roll call vote, please?
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Nay. Representative Reinbold.
No.
Nay. Representative Kopp.
No.
Nay. Representative Kreis-Tompkins.
No.
Nay. Representative Ledoux.
No.
Nay. Representative Bansler.
No, I guess.
Representative Clayman.
Yes.
Okay, 1 yay, 6 nays.
We're going to go back real quick, since we still have Ms. Martin on the line, and retake up amendment number 2. We've already had a motion. There has there's an objection on the record. Representative Reinbold wanted to have perhaps Ms. Martin just speak to making sure that representative that amendment number 2 does what we're told it is. So maybe if Ms. Martin could just explain that.
Yeah, again, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. I'm sorry, I didn't listen to your earlier hearing.
Oh, yes, sorry. So amendment number 2 for us is 30-LS0193/U.6. And this is, there was previously Representative Clayman explained to us what this did, and I believe Representative Reinbold's question was to have perhaps Ledge Legal call in and also explain what it did or confirm what it does.
Okay, yeah, through the chair. Amendment number 2 repeals existing statute 1236050, and then what are new sections 10 and 11 in the amendment are conforming changes because 050 was repealed, and then section 1236320 in the bill is very similar language, so the reference was updated from 050 to 320.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If even for the benefit of those listening, can you just carefully go over what 1236050 that we're repealing does?
Yeah, Representative Reinbold, through the chair. 1236050 is it's also titled Remission of Forfeited Property, but it specifically talks about remission of a weapon that's been forfeited, and the language in the bill of 1236320 is almost identical, except it covers all property, not just weapons. And then the number 4, the bona fide purchaser for fair value, is not a current requirement in 1236050.
Representative Reinbold, follow-up.
Okay, so just your final conclusion, it basically just streamlines the law, and it includes firearms. Is that correct, I mean, in layman's terms?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair. Yeah, the two sections, 1236050, that's being repealed, it just dealt with weapons, and then 1236320 applies to all property. So it would be fairly duplicative to have both.
Okay. Just Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Reinbold.
So this just expands the scope of returned property to include firearms. Is that correct?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, 1236050 only applied to weapons, and that's the one that's repealed. The new bill section applies to all property.
Representative Ledoux.
No, I just realized that this amendment does exactly what I wanted it.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's good.
Any further discussion on amendment number 2? Okay.
Devastatingly witty comebacks come to you no sooner than 4 hours after the occasion sometimes, and whenever they arrive, it's a good thing.
Okay, we're not quite making the Kessel run in 12 parsecs, but we are trying our best here. Who had the objection?
I can't remember. For amendment, I think it was it 2? David number 2. Was it you or me that had objection?
I think I might have.
I think it's you.
In that case, I withdraw my objection.
Okay, and just in case, Representative Reinbold, would you withdraw? Yes. Okay. There are no objections that I've heard as of this time, so that means amendment number 2 is adopted, and I will pass the gavel back to Chair Clayman.
Next on our list, thank you, Chancellor. Next is Amendment 5. Representative Kopp, do you want to move Amendment 5?
I withdraw Amendment 5.
And how about Amendment 6?
I withdraw Amendment 6.
And actually, technically, it's probably not offering, but either way, we're at the same place. Next, Amendment 7, Representative Eastman.
Yes, I move the adoption of Amendment number 7.
Object for discussion.
Representative Eastman, if you could briefly tell us Amendment 7. What's the purpose of Amendment 7?
Certainly. Well, the cause that leads me to move the amendment is simply this. Currently, we ask our law enforcement to focus on convictions and preserving evidence and such, and we don't have any counterbalance to ensure or at least to minimize re-victimizing our victims of crime. So I give you one case that I'm familiar with where a mother had the unfortunate experience of having her car carjacked while she was in it with her daughter, I believe. And the car was found and it was seized as evidence, leaving her with no car and no way to get to work, and really just perpetuate, I mean, basically it made her victimization terribly worse than had the car simply been stolen. Because, you know, here she has no car, the state has the car, she can't get the car. She has to fight and fight and fight and fight to get the car. Inevitably, victims' rights steps in and petitions, and at the end of the day, the car comes back. But it seems to me like what we've set up is those types of things to continue to happen. So what I would like to see happen, either through this amendment or through some other language, is let's counterbalance the ask that we're giving to law enforcement to pursue the conviction with at some point making a reasonable determination, is the conviction, even if that conviction is not possible, is that worth more than the actual injury that our Alaska residents and crime victims might suffer in going through with it? So obviously a win-win would be to
establish. Representatives, I ask you to focus on the amendment itself, not an amendment that's not before us.
Yeah, so this amendment specifically is you know, sets a timeline of 120 days. And I think that's a reasonable amount of time at which, you know, a trigger should happen where you make a determination that property should go back to the crime victim. Anything longer than that, I think, is probably not doing well in the grand scheme of things. And I think, you know, as a caveat, if you have an expectation that this sort of thing is going to happen, you're not going to get your you know, property back, then I think you unfortunately, you know, we lose confidence as a public with our law enforcement, not because they're not doing what we ask them to do, but because they're doing exactly what we ask them to do. And right now we're asking them not to give property back in these particular types of situations. So the amendment is going to it's going to nudge law enforcement to speed up the process.
Thank you very much. I understand from conversations beforehand that the Department of Law has some concerns with Amendment Number 7, so rather than hear committee discussion, I'll actually ask Mr. Skidmore to come and address Amendment Number 7 from the Department of Law's perspective. And I would specifically ask that you address in that whether there are constitutional issues that this amendment may raise.
For the record, my name again is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. And while I appreciate the sentiment that we want to ensure that we get property back to victims or innocent third-party owners as quickly as possible, from our perspective, we believe that this would actually violate the Constitution. The case that I mentioned to you all last week over the phone of Thorne, I can actually give you a citation if that's helpful. Thorne is the case that specifically indicates, goes back to other Alaska Supreme Court cases that establish due process rights. Those due process rights of defendants require that the evidence be preserved until the time of the trial. Under this situation in which property had to be returned within 120 days, that theoretically probably more than theoretically, create substantial problems for the prosecution of any number of cases. I can tell you one quick example. When I was a prosecutor in Dillingham, we were prosecuting a double homicide in which a 14-year-old girl was raped and then murdered and her body placed into a landfill. It took us 6 months to solve that case. 6 months. So that's 2 months longer than 30 days. For us to have to return property in those circumstances would have compromised our ability to file charges and to ultimately bring the individual who's responsible to justice. He ultimately received a 99-year sentence. So that's the sort of thing that you're really talking about doing with this amendment. And I appreciate the sentiment that's expressed by Representative Eastman, and I agree with it, that we need to do a better job, and we need to find a good way to return property to folks whenever we can do so. I'm just afraid that this amendment is not the right way to achieve that.
Representative Reinbold has a question. Mr. Skidmore?
Yes, I do. I tend to understand where you're coming from, but yet I think Representative Eastman has a very important point. There's over 2,000 vehicles stolen. The Constitution also says that they should enjoy the benefits of their labor. Well, the car is part of their labor and getting to work, and it just sounds outrageous to me that if a car is stolen and they have no way to get to work, I mean, they're being re-victimized over and over again. I mean, what's your solution to that? I think it's a very important point.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I agree with you, and that's what I was indicating, is that I do believe that we need to try and find a way to get more property back. I don't have the answer because I sit here today. It's certainly something that the Department of Law has been working on. You mentioned vehicles. I can tell you that over 2 years, I'm going to say it was 3 years ago, we instituted a new policy for return of vehicles. It's not only victimizing the folks that don't have the use of their vehicles, but it also is extremely expensive for law enforcement to continue to store them. And the policy that we instituted was that we should be filing motions to try and return property whenever we could, particularly when it applied to things like vehicles. What it requires is for a prosecutor or a defense attorney to file a motion with the court to have property returned to the person that was seized from. The other party has an opportunity to respond, and the court ultimately rules on it. Absent going through that process, then we have the constitutional problems. But the answer is to try and get more property returned through that court process.
Representative Reinbold, follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You're real smart. You're one of the smartest lawyers I've ever met. And I truly believe that you can find an amendment to this amendment that would allow us, you know, unless the courts or the prosecution absolutely has to have that, then it needs to be, you know, given back to the Alaskans, you know, or the victim of crime. So, you know, with that, I think this is a very important issue that needs to be addressed, not later, but now. I mean, soon. And so I'm definitely going to back up my colleague and expect, you know, some sort of an amendment to an amendment so we can get this addressed before this bill goes anywhere, if I have any say-so in this.
Representative Reinwald, I'll just remind you that the Department of Law is not part of the legislature, and they have no obligation to propose amendments. If Representative Eastman proposed this amendment, we've been told that it violates the Constitution. We can do as we
and
wish.
And I'll say it violates the Constitution in another place, so, you know, but in the opposite way.
Any other
way.
Comments or questions? Representative, you get to wait, Representative Eastman. It's your amendment, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly agree with the sentiment Representative Eastman brings up of just getting property back to owners. This, I would just remind this committee that this legislature in 2014 passed AS 1236-070, which is return of property by hearing, and that directly gets at this amendment, and that is a crime victim who is the owner of property not belonging to a law enforcement agency that's in the custody of that agency may request a hearing two different ways, either one through OVR or directly to the agency. And once that request has been made, that agency has 10 days to request a hearing before the court.
And if OVR doesn't request it, the agency can. But either one can request it, but it has to be done within 10 days. And then at the hearing, the court, the party that objects to the property being returned has to state on the record the reason for their objection, and the court will decide if the property in the custody of the law enforcement agency, by using the standard of preponderance of the evidence, does the crime victim show that the satisfactory proof of ownership? Does the party objecting to the return of the property fail to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the property must be retained by the agency for evidentiary purposes? And if the court orders the return of the property to the crime victim, the court may impose reasonable conditions on the return. Court may include order that the crime victim retain and store the property so the property is available for future court hearings, require photographs to be taken, or any other condition the court considers necessary to maintain the evidentiary integrity of the property. This was well vetted through, I think, three legislative sessions before we finally got it through, but it totally addresses what this amendment is driving at, and it gives authority to crime victims to bring it up. The problem with setting a 120-day time limit, as the AG's office has pointed out, is that certain trials just take a very long time, years sometimes for some major ones. But even in those type of situations, this statute specifically allows a person to petition the court to have a hearing on this very issue and decide if the evidentiary value that the state's claiming outweighs the crime victim getting their property back. And I think it addresses it. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate those previous comments. I have a clarifying question. Maybe I'm struggling to read Amendment Number 7 properly, but on the last line on page 1 of Amendment Number 7, line 23, there's a semicolon and then an and. And my question is, because there's an and, that would suggest, formatting it. I'm dialed in. Thank you, Chair Klayman. Thank you.
Any more questions?
None at all.
Representative Eastman, in wrap-up as Amendment Number 7.
Well, certainly, and there's nothing against, you know, asking questions of the maker of the amendment. Usually, I think they're glad to answer. But here is another issue that this relates to, which I'm sure has not escaped many of you. So currently we're in a situation where we have, because of recently passed legislation, we have cases that are not being prosecuted. For whatever reason, we have cases not being prosecuted. And we have vehicles being stolen, and even when, after whatever process the state goes through, they determine there's a way to prosecute, they decide not to prosecute the case. And this is all, in the backdrop of the system is not working the way that I think it should and that we would like to see it designed to. In my district just this last weekend we had another case.
Representative Eastman, these are very interesting comments, but I don't see how they have anything to do with this amendment that's before us, in which you're suggesting there be 120 days if the property hasn't been returned, it has to be returned immediately. And I think, while it's interesting comments, we kind of overtime, and let's focus on the amendment that's before us and why we should either adopt that amendment or not adopt the amendment.
Yes, so the second and third portions of this amendment deal strictly with situations in which a suspect has not been identified, has not been charged, and we are giving the owner of the property the opportunity to waive their claim to allowing that property to be used in the prosecution. Doesn't mean that it absolutely won't, but we are asking them to make a decision on whether or not they want to risk possibly the evidence not being sufficient to pursue a conviction. against the person who violated their property rights. And that, to me, seems a very reasonable thing to do, especially in the backdrop of cases that are not going to prosecution. There's nothing unconstitutional about this. If there's anything unconstitutional, it might be pursuing prosecution in a case in an unconstitutional manner. There's nothing about this here saying that that has to happen. No, if anything, there might be fewer cases that go to prosecution, but we already know there are fewer cases going to prosecution, which is why I propose the amendment. Thank you.
Are we allowed to comment?
That was wrap-up comments.
Oh, I know, but I had a comment before he had a comment. But
go ahead, Representative. And I would note that Megan Webb from the Public Defender Agency is available for questions. I neglected to note that earlier, but go ahead, Representative Ryan.
I just think that this is such an important issue, and I really like the fact that this amendment says that they shall return it, because right now, and I really appreciate Representative Kopp's points about what we did back in 2014, but it still puts the victim or the person without the property, you know, that got, some people say, seized from them because of a crime, but it still puts them in the mother may I have a hearing, I like this because it puts the victim more in the hot seat, you know, in the empowered, and it also causes these guys who have seized the property to quit withholding so much. I know that I have been a victim of crime, and I never got my property back, ever. Even though the guy got convicted, he got thrown behind bars, I never have gotten my property back. So I think there's real serious issues with holding evidence and holding property, and I really want this to be solved. And I still would ask Department of Law to work with me in regards to getting this addressed. The bottom line is the executive branch, I know he doesn't have to work with amendments, but I can tell you that it seems like the executive branch is pretty much running the legislature right now with all their rebuttals, with their testifying, with their carrying their bills.
Representative Reinbold, that's a little beyond the scope of this amendment.
I'm just saying, you guys brought it up where he doesn't have to help me, you know, write an amendment, but I tell you, there's probably 1,000 people in the executive branch working with different members.
Reinbold,
in some way or another.
I didn't say that he didn't need to work with you. I said he didn't need to write the amendment.
Right, but he, with all...
Words that I didn't say.
Well, the bottom line is that I think that this is a very, very important issue, and I think that people have the right to their property, especially if they're a victim of crime, and I do think that it needs to be given back more quickly. So I'm hoping that this committee will have a hearing in regards to what is the process to return property back to the victim, since we're working on this issue. So that would be a request I'm making at this time, and I do support the amendment.
All right. I will just note that, having been a victim of crime myself from time to time, and also having done some prosecution, although not to the extent that Mr. Skidmore has, I wouldn't want to be the prosecutor that had to look at a victim of crime who had lost a loved one or somebody else and said, well, we couldn't prosecute that because we gave that piece of property back because that statute gave us no choice. And I wouldn't want to be the prosecutor having to look at the victim saying, we lost that prosecution because the legislature told us to do it in 120 days. And so with that...
Well, let us rebut that, please.
I'm sorry?
Can we make a comment to that?
Go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
That's exactly our point, why we wanted an amendment to the amendment, so that in extreme circumstances where... that they absolutely needed it, that we could do that. But with the same thing, I don't want 2,000 people not to be able to go to work and lose their jobs and not be able to feed their family because the state's keeping their car. I mean, we can do stories like that too, rhetorical. All right. So in all fairness, I think an amendment is worthy on this amendment.
Representative Fansler, is the objection maintained?
Yes.
If you could... Representative Eastman, we're really running late.
I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I know what he's
Go saying. Ahead, Representative Eastman.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to withdraw this amendment at this time.
And
I would welcome input from the department and from members of the committee
right.
So that we can get this right. I don't think we're right where we are now.
All right. So amendment number 7 is not adopted and has been withdrawn. Based on the vote as to amendment number 4, we will not be moving this bill from committee today. I will I am not going to appoint anyone from the committee. I would encourage everyone on the committee to communicate with my office, because we will be working on an alternative to Amendment 4 that we will do all our best to finish that, hopefully by tomorrow afternoon, worst case sometime on Wednesday morning. But stay in touch with us, because that's how you participate. I'm not going to schedule any informal meetings at this time, but keep talking with us, because we've heard all the discussion. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 29 at 1 p.m. We will continue again with House Bill 42, which we are just finished discussing. We'll also hear House Bill 43, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill, sponsored by Representative Gren, and House Bill 108, Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets, sponsored by my office. It remains my intention to move 108 out of committee, as well as House Bill 42 out of committee on Wednesday. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 108, or for that matter, an amendment different than what we're going to be discussing about House Bill Amendment 4 to House Bill 42, please let my office know, and be sure to submit those amendments by 5 p.m. tomorrow. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 3:18 p.m.